This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Each year in the United States, thousands of youths are convicted of crimes and sentenced as adults to serve time in adult prisons. In the book Boy with a Knife, a story of murder, remorse, and a prisoner's fight for justice, Gene Traunstein explores the story of Carter Reed. Reed was convicted of second-degree murder when he was 16 for stabbing another teenager to death in a high school classroom in a town near Boston. Sentenced to life in prison, Reed served 20 years before suing the parole board and being released. Gene Traunstein joins us to discuss Boy with a Knife and the practice of incarcerating youth in adult prisons. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Gene, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
How did it come about that you ended up writing the story of Carter Reed?
Well, that's a great question. I actually met Carter through a letter. I am a teacher. I teach at college in Middlesex Community College in Massachusetts, and I have a class in prison literature and was preparing for that class, and I've been a teacher there for a long time and worked in prison for 10 years, but I never had worked with men or corresponded with anyone in prison, and I got a letter from Carter asking me for help for parole, not for himself, but for a woman friend of his. And I was very tentative about answering him because I'd always gone by the mantra, a woman in prison is not a dangerous man. And so I had a certain amount of fear about writing somebody who identified himself as a murderer when he was a child. And what was fascinating to me is that I looked at this letter, it was so articulate, and then I Googled, like we all would, to find out who this person was, and what was said about him in the press, and what was said about him in the courts in terms of his crime, the brutality, the horribleness, he was called a monster, was so different from the person who was in the letter. And I was fascinated by that. I wanted to know why. And I guess that is the impulse I had. I wrote him back. I didn't expect a correspondence, but I asked him about himself. And he wrote me, again, a very, very long letter about his life, and it began to interest me, and we just started corresponding. I had no idea I would write a book at that time, but I started exploring his case, and I am a writer, I thought, well, maybe I'll write an article about this. I'll look into juvenile justice issues and why kids are sentenced as adults. I didn't know anything about that. And that was it. That got me on the path to trying to understand what I've now come to understand is a really major crisis in our country of what we're doing with kids.
So you initially thought this would be a magazine article, but then it turned into a book.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even know if what would happen. Initially, I wasn't writing him to write an article, but yes, eventually.
And he wasn't writing you. He wasn't trying to get your help initially either.
Well, he
for himself at least.
Right, not for himself. No, and there was just it's interesting. Letters are such a lost art in our country, and I remember writing letters, but we don't write letters anymore. We write emails, and in a letter, you have time to really talk and think, and you wait for a response. It's very civilized. It's very interesting to have that. I mean, Carter and I wrote for 6 years. It took me 7 years to write the book, and I never knew during the process of writing the book what would happen to him.
So Carter was convicted in 1993 for killing a classmate, Jason Robinson. So, Gene, can you tell us what happened the day that Carter stabbed Jason? What led up to all this?
Well, Carter, interestingly enough, was a white boy, and as we know now, many more penalties for children of color than for a white person. But Carter was poor, so he was living in the town of New Bedford, Massachusetts, a very poor town, a lot of drugs, crime in that town. His father was a drug addict. His family was in turmoil. The father actually went to prison for cocaine 2 years before he committed his crime. But Carter had been a decent, kind of a kid growing up. He was an altar boy. He felt loved. But then things went south. His father started with the drugs. His mother started drinking. And not to make excuses for him, and he doesn't make excuses for himself, but his family was in chaos. His town, you know, he didn't have a lot to do, skateboarding and so on. And he got involved with kids like a lot of boys do who were maybe even more outrageous in some ways than he was, and he was influenced by his peers. And one day, one of his friends said, we're going to do this. We're going to go get back for a fight. And Carter wanted to prove himself. He'd never felt like a strong kid, a kid who made a difference. And they decided to get back. One of their friends had called, his mother had been slurred by one of the other kids, and she was dead. And as happens with so many kids, we're going to get back. Loyalty is so much for these kids. Loyalty is everything. So one group against another group, they go into a school. This is in 1993, before the proliferation of monitors in school or policemen, and they actually went into a classroom to solve this fight, thinking, or not thinking, will, that they could actually, you know, they could actually do such a thing. And they were armed. And when I say armed, I don't mean guns. Carter had a billy club, and Gator had a bat. Now, Carter carried a knife every day of his life for protection. And he had that knife in his pocket, so when the billy club was taken away and chaos ensued in the classroom, and a boy who was a part of this group was saying, you know, this is, you know, what are you doing, and all this chaos, and his friend was running around the room with a baseball bat, Carter was, I have to do something to help. I've never helped my friends before. He pulls out a knife, and in his really kind of crazy juvenile thinking, stabs a boy, not realizing, Jason Robinson, that he would die, because in Carter's mind it was, I'm going to hurt him, I'm going to get back. And, you know, hours later, after he was arrested and taken down to the police station in a cell, he found out the boy had died. And he was so self-absorbed at the time, he didn't even realize that he had killed a boy. His first thought was, oh my God, I'm going to be in so much trouble. And that, unfortunately, is not atypical of kids.
When you were corresponding with Carter, did you get the impression that he was remorseful for what had happened?
Absolutely, but I took a long time. It didn't. Well, let me say this. He was remorseful after. There were stages of this, and I think there's stages of this as a person grows up. He began to realize, I'd say, really the full weight of what he'd done after about 5 years. And at that point, he was 21. And at that point, he was in an adult prison. That's a sort of a different story we can get to in a minute. But the remorse came in waves. And he told me that he woke up one day after he was involved in this program, Project Youth, where he talked to kids about his crime. And you can talk about your crime and you can talk about your crime. And so eventually he realized he had to take total responsibility for the murder, and he did. And that remorse is still with him today. I mean, every day he thinks about that he killed Jason Robinson. He can't. I think that's not also atypical of kids. You don't get kids who kill. Most kids do want to come to grips with what they've done.
Gene, who made the decision to try him as an adult? How did that come about?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that, Mark. But this happened at the time in the country when, and you've heard this term now bandied about, where we had the super predator fear. And that was a term mostly applied to young black kids. If anyone out there remembers the Central Park 5 case, or there were cases where, you know, crime was going up in the country, and we felt crime would continue to go up in 1993, which we were mistaken about. Juvenile crime went down. But there was a fear that these kids would keep, so to speak, pillaging and plundering. And laws were changed all around the country, and I'm sure in Ohio as well, to actually be much harsher for kids. And what that means is that no longer did the juvenile system have sway. Kids could be transferred from the juvenile system to the adult system all over the country and tried as adults. Now, in Massachusetts, the automatic age is 14. At that time, 1993, you had to be transferred if you were under 18. So we've gotten even harsher in some ways. And we now are left with these laws, even though Miller v. Alabama says that if you are tried and convicted of first-degree murder, you have to have eligibility for parole. Carter was tried for first-degree murder, but he was not convicted of first-degree murder. He was convicted of second-degree murder. But that tone in the country was what was affecting why Carter was transferred. There was a tone and a feeling of, these kids are bad kids. These kids are monsters. We have to put them away.
So it was the feeling that ended up with him, and the judge, of course, followed that and decided to sentence him to adult prison.
Yeah, well, he was tried by a jury, and the jury convicted him of second degree murder. And if you were convicted of second degree murder, when he was transferred from the juvenile, there was a hearing in juvenile court, and the juvenile court decided he would be tried in the adult court. And once he was tried in adult court, then he had to go by adult laws. So if a kid can stay in a juvenile court, they can go to a juvenile facility. I think the country believes that it's very easy to do time in a juvenile facility, which is not true. They have a lot of rules. I mean, imagine you're a 16-year-old kid, and you're taken away from your family, your friends, today, your Game Boy, your iPad, your computer, your cell phone, all the things that give you identity. That is what prison is. It's not punishment when you're behind bars, but indeed, once you put someone with adults, you risk safety issues. Kids are more likely to be raped, although we have precautions against that. Of course, it still happens. It's much harder to be in an adult prison. There's gangs. There's lots of ways kids try to prove themselves, to be tough, much harder.
We will continue our conversation with Gene Trounstein about Boy with a Knife, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and my guest this afternoon is Gene Trounstein. Her latest book is Boy with a Knife. It tells the story of Carter Reed, who was convicted at age 16 for killing a classmate and sentenced to life in prison. After serving 20 years, he sued the parole board and was released. You can join us this afternoon at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can join us on Facebook or Twitter. Gene, do you know how many youths these days are being held in adult prisons?
10,000 a year is what we're estimating. When I started the book, we used to say 250,000 every year are tried and sentenced and go through the adult system. Since crime has dropped, it's now 200,000, but 10,000 a day.
Now, what's the recidivism rate for teens who are convicted and sentenced as adults compared to teens who are sentenced to juvenile jails?
It's one-third higher for kids who actually go through the adult system versus going through the juvenile system in a match study that was done by crime.
Did they look at why it's so much higher?
Well, I'm not sure they did in the study that I'm talking about, but in other literature that I've read, the reasons have to do with becoming, quote, more hopeless, more hardened to crime, less able to get jobs, getting out in long periods of time. If you're in an adult prison, you often serve a much longer period of time than if you serve in a juvenile facility. And not getting, importantly, not getting education and job training, because it's one size fits all when you go to an adult place. And when you go to a juvenile place, there's much more age-appropriate programming. So that affects you when you get out, because reentry, as we all know, is really so important to what happens to people who come out of prison. What's going to happen to them? What kind of citizens can they become? And that's what I think I'm concerned about as well.
In terms of reentry, Jean, in Ohio, we banned the box, so to speak, and mm-hmm. that's been a movement in places around the country. What effect do you see that having?
Well, interestingly enough, it's had two effects that I think are really kind of unfortunate. One effect is, I mean, it's a positive thing in that many people get a second chance at an interview. The box is something that says you can't, you automatically, if you're convicted of a felony, you don't have an opportunity for a job or sometimes college application, different kinds of boxes, different places. But the problem is that once you get the interview, what happens then? And in many cases, well, most cases, I mean, a potential employer is going to ask you about your background, understandably. But it's the attitudes of the employers that are problematic, because the attitudes are, I don't want someone who is a convicted felon. I'm not really willing to give that person a second chance. The other thing that more recently has been shown, and this is hasn't been followed up, but it's fairly disturbing to me, is that what also happens is that people of color, when they don't admit that they have a felony, are often screened out because their employers assume that they are more likely to have a criminal background when they're not asked if they have one or they don't have one. And that's an unfortunate sort of side effect. I think ultimately we have to work on educating people to give people who get out of prison a second chance. I mean, that's what we have to do, and it's not easy, because all of us are faced with what we, you know, the preconceptions we have. But a lot of people are running around who have criminal backgrounds, and we don't know about it, and they're doing just fine in having jobs and getting homes and trying to be back in our society again.
Jean, do you think any juvenile should ever be sentenced as an adult?
I personally think that the juvenile system can function the same way the system functions, let me just say, in Missouri. In Missouri, there's a wonderful program sponsored by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, where there are three levels of facilities where juveniles are held. If you've killed somebody or you are considered dangerous, you're held, let's call it level 3, where you have to work yourself to get to level 2 or level 1. So you have to go through the kinds of things good parents would put their kids through to get them from time out back to being able to have, you know, responsibilities. But many things that can happen there that wouldn't happen in adult prison are the kids have responsibilities. They're given more counseling. They're given more education. So they're given programming to work themselves to level 2. They come to see their responsibilities more clearly. So they don't just get something. They have to earn it. That's the kind of, but they have hope because they can earn it. That's the kind of system I want, where there's hope for kids, but they have to earn it. That is, I think, the kind of child that I think we want in our society, where they're out there doing good things, believing they have possibilities, but they don't think it's, quote, a free ride.
Gina, what about weighing the severity of the crime, though? Aren't there times when the crime is just so severe it really does warrant an adult sentence and being sent to adult prison?
Well, I think a lot of people would agree with that. I think that that's why we have the kinds of situations we're in now, where we have over 2 million people incarcerated in the United States, more than any other country in the world, where we give harsher sentences to kids than any place in the world. I think we need to be looking at what happens to the person, and do we want to allow them a chance to change? The Supreme Court says a child who commits even the most heinous of crimes is capable of change. I go with that. It doesn't mean they will change, and it doesn't mean they should get out, but it means they are given a chance to change.
What about the perspective, though, that you hear sometimes from victims about obtaining justice for the victims?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've heard that a lot of people feel that, first of all, you can't equate. There is nothing that can bring a person back. Jason Robinson's death was unbelievably horrible and unforgivable on a certain level. But what brings peace to the person who is a victim of crime? The more I've been reading a lot about that lately, and the more I read, the more I see that we need restorative justice. We need something to heal the community, because it's not just the victim. It's the victim, the victim's family, it's the family of the perpetrator, it's the community, it's an entire group of people who are harmed. How do you bring healing is my question. So, I'm kind of a Shakespeare fanatic. I go with mercy needs to season justice. And I think that is the way to heal, is to think of what will bring the most for all the parties involved. And so I'm really looking into restorative justice more and more now to see if I can write some things about that and look at that side of the picture. The victims absolutely need attention. It's incredibly important. But how to help them heal, that's the question. I don't think putting somebody away for the rest of their life who killed their child is going to help them heal.
So we've been talking about what happens in the aftermath. What about being preventative on this? How can society be preventive on these issues? How do we reduce violence among young people in the U.S.?
Well, when I was talking with Carter the other day, somebody asked him what would have helped him. I thought that was interesting. And he said he needed someone to pay attention to him. First of all, he was ignored. What he was doing was ignored. So I'd say the first thing is we have to pay attention to what's going on with our kids on a really deep level. And that's number one. Second of all, there has to be support for kids. I mean, I personally think when I was a kid, if you got in trouble, you went to the principal's office and somebody said, okay, sit here, and the worst thing that could happen is they'd call your mother. And if your mother found out you'd gotten in trouble, you got it when you got home. But now a police officer can come in and take a kid who has a temper tantrum to a police station. I don't think we need to make crime. I don't think we need to make behavior criminal. I think we need to take the criminal out of behavior and treat it as behavioral problems. So that's another thing. Our schools can help with that. I don't think they've shown statistically the more resource officers we have in schools, often the more crime there is, not the other way around. So I think we need to attend to our schools. The school-to-prison pipeline is a true thing. Kids, when you start criminalizing them young, they get in trouble later. I think we have to attend to that. I think all of our attention has to be to, not making behavior always a criminal act, but something that needs to be attended to way before it gets to that point.
Gene, did you happen to talk with the family of Jason Robinson when you were writing the book?
I didn't talk to them when I was, I went to a parole hearing where they were at, and I saw them, and I did not go down to talk to them intentionally because I didn't want to intervene, and I also thought they would prohibit the book from being published, which is, interestingly, what happened afterwards, but they were very angry at me for publishing this book about someone who had killed Jason. However, the kind of amazing thing that happened is there was a protest, and in the end, I did get to have the sister did come in and talk to me for about 20 minutes, cried and yelled and told me her feelings, and I just told her Carter wasn't going to become famous or make money off the book, which he didn't, and I think I allayed some of her fears, but after 23 years, she was still in enormous pain, and I think that says something about how we don't help people who are in that kind of pain. So I mean, she suffered enormously, and her whole family did.
So, Jean, what's Carter been doing since he won his release?
Carter graduated from community college with a 4.0 average, and interestingly enough, was not allowed to be in Phi Theta Kappa because of his crime. He's still on parole. He's on lifetime parole. He bought a house. Well, he has a job. He got a job after a while. It took him a while, but he got a job. He works night shift and became a manager. Bought a house. Took his father in, who's out of prison for quite some time. His father didn't have a home for a while, and his half brother, and is trying to help his half brother, who's at the same point that he was when he got in trouble. So he's also working toward helping. He wants to work to help mentor kids. That's not so easy when you have a criminal record, but that's what he wants to do. Mm. So he's doing very well, and I don't think he's unusual. I think he's not unique. I really want to say that to people.
You think there are a lot of kids like this in the system?
I do think there are kids like this. I think you can be incredibly damaged, but I think there are a lot of kids, when they are given a chance, like Carter, who really will do well when they get out.
Now, you'll be in Cincinnati on June the 29th, Jean, I believe, to speak at the Mercantile Library?
Yes, I'll be there at 6 o'clock, and I'll be joined by Kim Tandy, who's the executive director of the Children's Law Center in Kentucky, which also serves Ohio. And I'll be talking and reading from Boy with a Knife, and she'll be also involved in questions, and I think it should be a great evening.
Well, Jean, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Jean Trounstein, her latest book is Boy with a Knife, a story of murder, remorse, and a prisoner's fight for justice. Coming up, we'll have a look at the Kentucky Speedway, now in its 16th year of racing, and Focus on Technology looks at how scientists may use your own stem cells to repair your body. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.